Basrola Ikaza.
Translates as For Freedom in English, is a song by the Iranian singer Shirvan Hoshapour that is about the protest against Iranians ruling theocracy after the death of Mahsa Amin in September 22. The song begins with the lyrics, "For dancing in the streets, for the fear we feel when we kiss." The song Bahariye Azada lists reasons why young Iranians protested online and in the streets. In 2023, Hoshapour won the Grammy Award for Best Song for Social Change for his song Bahariye. We here at Solutions of Balance and our guest today, Farah Mosterai Sharveh, would like to see an Iranian change that leads to freedom for the Iranian people. Welcome, friends. We are Forward Radio, WFMP 106.5 FM, and you are listening to The Excess Hour, a program sponsored by Forward Radio. The Excess Hour is your doorway to voicing your opinion over the WFMP 106.5 FM radio airways. The Excess Hour is one of two programs on WFMP radio that invites our listeners to speak your mind on WFMP radio airways. Just go to forwardradio.org and click on Participate if you are interested in producing a one-time broadcast. I'm Jim Johnson. Our editor today is Carolyn Brooks Johnson. The following is part of WFMP's public affairs educational programming. The views expressed are those of our guests, not necessarily the views of the station, nor its board of directors. If you'd like to share your views, you may contact us by sending us an email at solutionsofviolence18@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Today's guest on the Excess Hour is Farah Mosterai Sharveh. Farah Mosterai Sharveh was the keynote speaker at the Louisville Fellowship of Reconciliation and Source of Justice's Third Thursday Lunch event. The Third Thursday Lunch event that features Farah Mosterai Sharveh occurred April 18th before a live Zoom audience. We'd like to thank the Louisville Fellowship of Reconciliation and Source of Justice for helping to produce today's presentation that featured Farah Mosterai Sharveh. Farah's presentation is about the history of Iran, the struggles faced by the Iranian women, and how the United States has at times intervened in Iranian domestic affairs. LFOR's Beverly Marmion will welcome our listeners, and LFOR's Pat Geyer will introduce Farah Mosterai Sharveh.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Beverly Marmion, and I'm the chair of the Third Thursday Lunch Committee. Today, we're not lunching, we're Zooming, in order to feature our speaker today, Farah Mokhtarzadeh, speaking about the women of Iran from her perspective as a feminist. April is our last program of our series, and so we will be departing until next September, but today we're going to focus on the Middle East, in particular Iran. Many of us know Farah Mokhtarzadeh because she is one of the leaders of the ceasefire in Gaza now. We have been with her for the last more than 6 months on that particular pilgrimage, but in any case, it's obvious from Farah's biography as a peacemaker that she could speak to us on several different topics of great interest. But for today, because the Fellowship of Reconciliation has always been a people-to-people organization, in terms of its peacemaking efforts, we wanted to talk to her about her studies regarding women in Iran and their struggles, as well as, of course, drawn from her own experiences in the Middle East. Our program is going to go along as in this order. Pat Geyer, our co-chair, is going to introduce Farah. And after Farah's talk, Pat is going to moderate the question and answer period. So, and we hope there'll be a lot of those. So, Pat Geyer to introduce Farah.
Thank you. This is really a pleasure and a privilege for me to introduce Farah today. And I want to say, first of all, that she is the daughter of an Irish Catholic mother, and you will note that by her lovely Irish accent, and of an Iranian father, and you will note that by her last name, none of which we don't seem to be able to pronounce that, so I'll do my best. I met Farah in 2001, and that happened because she, as a recent high school graduate at that time, had worked with Kathy Kelly in Chicago. I think, Farah, most of your childhood was in Chicago, and knew Kathy Kelly. That may not be a name that most of you know, but if you you don't know it, it's a name you should know. Kathy is one of the icons, I think, of our age. And she had founded, on the run-up to the Iraq War, Kathy had founded an organization called Voices in the Wilderness. And the purpose of that organization, as I understand it, was to protest, to sort of push back against the horrible, severe U.S. embargo on Iraq. This is on the run-up to the war, which began in 2003. So Farah, as a young high school graduate, wanted to go on one of the delegations. The delegations to Iraq carried medical supplies that was totally in violation of the embargo. So Kathy referred Farah to Louisville FOR to ask for some financial help. And that is how Farah and I met. So, all right, fast forward, and it would be easier to introduce her if I had a world map. But since I don't have a world map, try to hang on to this, and I'll move through this quickly so we can get to Farah's remarks today. She attended the University of Pennsylvania, graduated with a degree in Middle Eastern Studies, and then she lived in Ireland from 2007 until 2019, principally during that time getting her master's and PhD in Feminist Islamic Studies in Catholic Ireland. Just note that. And also during that time, she traveled and worked in the Middle East, a number of different countries, and in Africa, I think. So, Farah, if I have any of this wrong, you can clean it up later. 2018 until 2020, she worked in Tanzania doing community work and teaching adult education. From 2020 until 2022, the end of 2022, she lived in Lebanon and Turkey, working with the Mennonite Central Committee and with social media programs. Then she contracted cholera. And she was in Lebanon. She had a severe case of cholera. She was in Lebanon during much of that time, got a little better, and then came back to Louisville where her father lives and convalesced from cholera. And did that pretty quickly because 10 months later, after October 7th, without knowing anybody in the Louisville community, she got names from me and others of activists, and she co-founded the Louisville Ceasefire Coalition. And if you don't know, that coalition has worked steadily and hard in the last 6 months to protest the Israeli-Gaza conflict and the ongoing genocide in Gaza. So without further ado, Farah, I welcome you.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Pat. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it very much. I'm just going to share my screen since I did do a PowerPoint for you. So let me just double check. You can see it all right, can you? To talk about Iran, it's such a big topic, and it's one that I realize has been a lot in the news, and especially for this kind of group of people, which I imagine are readers and, you know, follow the news and stuff like that. There's probably a lot you already know. I'm sure probably a lot you know better than me. So if there's a question or something that I don't say that you think is important, feel free to go ahead and say it. And I'm just going to be looking at my slides. So maybe Pat, you could help me if there's someone raises their hand or something, since I was going to put the faces down, just let me know and I'll stop. And really, I'm happy to stop at any point to take a question about anything. Let me just look at the time so I don't. So you can see my screen, I assume, yes? Mm-hmm. The Women, Life, Freedom slideshow. Okay. So I just wanted to start here because this poster has meant a lot to me in the last couple of years since the Women, Life, Freedom slogan became the four slogan in the organizing against the Islamic Republic. And I don't know if anybody reads Persian at all, but on the flag there, it says Zan Zendegi Azadi, which is the Persian for women, life, freedom. And I'll get into some more of where that slogan came from, because it actually does come from the Kurdish women's movement, and particularly the one in Turkey and Northern Iraq. I just included this because Pat had given that nice introduction about Kathy Kelly. I have a long, I worked and received all of my sort of political education, I think, through Voices and with Voices programs. And you can tell that by looking at this. If you know Kathy Kelly, she's in a number of these photographs. You'll see her here in Lebanon. Down here, we were in Afghanistan. And then down here, especially, is really important to me because that's a picture of me and Kathy. And I don't know if anybody would know who that other person is at all. I can't see you, so you just have to jump in. But do you see where my cursor is? Does anybody know who that is? Probably not, but worth a try. So that is That is Mohammed Mossadegh's grandson. And Kathy and I were in Geneva for a protest around the odious debt in Iraq. And Mohammed Mossadegh's grandson owns a Bibliothèque Mossadegh, a library in Geneva. I think he's passed now. This is a good number of years ago. But he did have a library in Geneva of all of the old family photographs and things from Mossadegh's time. Really interesting. And that library is still there if anybody is interested. And then I just peppered the photographs here of a lot of different vignettes from my life. So up here on the right is I lived in Syria. So that's in Syria. Down here is Afghanistan and one of the foremost women's rights activists and parliamentarians, Malaya Joya, there in Afghanistan. And then this picture up here, that's my dad in the 70s in Iran and just some protests in Ireland, etc. So and I do revere Leila Khaled. I wanted to start here just because I think this is an important context for people. Many people know that Iran used to be the Persian Empire. It was an empire for 12 centuries, which is obviously a really long time. And this is a map of its territorial peak. And you can see that it was really very, very large. You know, going from here, Egypt and Libya, all the way up to here in Greece, across, this is Turkey, this is the Levant, Iran is here, and this is Central Asia going all the way to India. So really covered a big area. And during this time, you might have heard the word Persepolis or Persepolis was the capital of Iran. This is the pre-Islamic period, but I think it's important because of the, for a lot of reasons that I'll just go into now. This is modern Iran today. I thought it was good to sort of contextualize where Iran is. It's really geopolitically important, straddling between basically the Middle East and Central Asia, surrounded by a number of countries. And right here, again, where my cursor is, it depends on who you ask, the Persian Gulf or the Shatt al-Arab, I don't take sides, is one of the most important and strategic waterways for natural gas and oil resources in the world. And it is one of the places that a lot of Europe and the US are really kind of afraid that Iran would close and that would cause a huge problem to, you know, oil trade in the world. So Iran really does hold a very geopolitical strategic position in the world. But I go to the right-hand side map as well, because a lot of people may or may not know Iran is different from a lot of the rest of the Middle East in the sense that it has a different culture and a different language. So Iranians, for the most part, aren't Arab. They are Persian. But 60% of the population of Iran is made up of ethnic minorities and 40% is made up of ethnic Persians. And so this map is the major ethnic groups. There's a lot more than this, kind of where they're located in Iran. And so my family is from right up here in this section. And we are, it says Turkish, but what they mean is Azerbaijani or we call them Azeris, and they speak a form of Turkish, and they're Turkic people, so that's why they say that, and then Kurds. So both my family comes from these two groups of people, but there are, like I said, a huge amount of minorities, including Arab Iranians. That's why I like to say that some Iranians are Arab, but it's a very small percentage, about 1.6 million total. And then many are Baluchi. And you might have heard that as well, because there has been some difficulties between Iran and Pakistan over the Baluchi separatist movement. And a lot of these sort of ethnic minority movements still organize in Iran, because Iran still does oppress some minorities, just like a lot of other countries in the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, when they were forming nation states. I think the ideology of that was to try to create a nation state where everybody, all these different ethnicities, spoke a single language. And oftentimes those states did that by force you know, they didn't do it nicely. So Ataturk, for example, in Turkey, adopted Turkish as the national language of Turkey, even though that country has so many different languages, including Kurdish. And the same and it happened in Iran. They adopted the Persian language and then they kind of oppressed or suppressed all the other ones. So, for example, if there are names that belong to ethnic minority that we are not allowed to use as our first names. And this came up particularly a couple of years ago when the state killed Mahsa Amini, this young woman who was killed by the state for not wearing her hijab correctly. I'll get into that more later. But her real first name is Jinha, but it's not registered in Iran as Jinha because you're not allowed to register a name that's not Persian. I think another slightly interesting point on this is that my name in particular is actually it comes from Arabic. It's very Arabic name. Farah means happiness in Arabic, but it's a very political name to have in the year that I was born in 1983, because that's after the revolution, 1979 revolution, and Farah was the Shah's wife's name, Farah Dibar, Farah Pahlavi. And so giving somebody the name Farah after 1979 is kind of showing an allegiance to the Shah, but also to like the ideology of secularism versus what is there now, which is basically Islamism. So even in our names are very political. I think the last kind of thing I want to say about that is that my father, his first language is Azari, but the process of putting down these ethnic minorities, created a situation where a lot of people lost the language. So my father, his first language is Azari. If he speaks to his second youngest brother, he speaks in Azari. Of course, he also speaks Farsi. But my dad's youngest brother, who is about 15 years younger than him, does not speak the language at all. And that was the first language of my grandfather and the second language of my grandmother. So it's sad that that process happened that way, so that, they don't speak Azari anymore. But there are still movements looking for equality of ethnic minority rights. I just wanted to share this as well. It might be a strange non sequitur, but I just wanted to say that when it comes to Iran and kind of what's happening these days, this is an important, I think, recognition is that there's, and I'll get more into it later, but there's a real sort of strain in Iranian revolutionary thinking that kind of straddles both secularism and Islam as being very critical of the West, and particularly certain things of the West, which are not what the media maybe always says. And those things are just sort of this rampant individualism, rampant neoliberal capitalism, and then also this idea of empire or colonialism. And I share this because And I wanted to make a big yellow arrow pointing towards Press TV to say this source comes from Press TV, which is the national TV broadcaster, in Iran. So it's not a great reliable source, but this actual map is correct. And I share it because, a lot of maybe we in the place of empire may not always recognize it. I think there's a lot of ways that we're blind to this, but people in other countries, especially a country like Iran, is not at all blind to it. They know this about the Americans, and this is a part, something of a discussion in Iran. So it's good to know that there's an awareness. And even I would say, maybe another way to think about it is if you ask the average 15-year-old in Iran, who is the president of the United States, they'd probably be able to tell you who that is, and maybe even the vice president and other people. Whereas if you did ask that of a 15-year-old in America, who's the president, or tell us anything about Iran, they might have some trouble. So it's just a perspective thing that I'm trying to bring through. And also to say that these are the U.S. bases in the Middle East. You can see that, we all know that Iraq, that the U.S. went to war against Iraq, they're on the West Hand side, went to war against Afghanistan. So this feeling of empire coming from the US, Europe, and actually Russia is something that Iran has shaped a lot of Iran's history and culture and also its current politics. When you look at this map, you begin to understand the difficult position that Iranians are in. No, I don't agree with the leadership of Iran, but I'm just saying that this is the kind of awareness that people have and work with when they think about or discuss contemporary politics. And that's also to say, again, I won't spend a lot of time on this, but it's also to say that, of course, America is an empire, but Iran also has a lot of hegemony in the world, but especially in the Middle East. And this is just to give you a kind of a sense of the countries that Iran does have a lot of political control over, and that, you know, form the quote unquote axis of resistance in the current formation. And anyway, a number of groups that follow Iran as well. So maybe when you have more time, you could have a look at this. And if anybody has questions, let me know. But I just wanted to say that Iran does have its own hegemony, not as big as the US, but still pretty big. I created all of these slides to kind of go along a historical timeline and bring things into that. So I'm not going to read through all of this stuff. I know there's a lot of words. I'll share this with everybody so you can have a look yourself. But I did really want to start by talking about the fact that Iran has had two major revolutions in the 20th century anyway, and almost three now, you know, 100 years later. But it's really Iran had its first major political revolution in the contemporary period in 1905. It's called the Constitutional Revolution. So before Iran looked like the nation state it does now, it was under a monarchy. There, like I said, it's been 12 centuries. If you go through the history, there are so many invasions into Iran and takeover of so many different groups that it's kind of a little bit too hard to go through in 30 minutes. But suffice it to say that it was a monarchy at the end of the 19th century. The monarchy's head was in Tabriz, which is the Azeri or the Turkic capital of Iran. But this revolution really brought about the current nation state of Iran and created sort of a more democratic system in Iran. So before that, we had sort of a despotic monarchy that just kind of exploited people. Most of Iran was under feudalism. The Constitutional Revolution introduced a constitutional monarchy and a parliamentary system in Iran. They called them majlis. And it introduced the different forms of government that we have, bicameral system. And so this exists today. So while today there is kind of a wrestling between a sort of autocratic or dictatorial system within the Islamic leadership, there still exists a parliament and a president, and people can vote for local parliamentarians. There are 290 seats in the Iranian Majlis, and 17 of those seats belong to women. So women can run. It is somewhat of a democracy, although the Guardian Council, which is the supreme Islamic leadership over the Majlis, kind of gets to decide who can run for office in the first place. And so it's limited, but it does exist. And I think, you know, it's important to say that because some people just say it's a dictatorship, and it's not. There is a Majlis. And that constitutional period was really interesting for women's rights as well, because it was the starting point of a lot of formations of different women's societies, women's newspapers, and women's organizing for suffrage and other rights. And that's, you see that picture there on the right hand side. That is the first women's association in Iran, 1906, in Tabriz, again in Azerbaijan. And those associations of women continue until this this day, not the same ones, but associations of women's, women's newspapers, etc., continue. And it's just to say, also in this time period, moving between the monarchy and the Majlis, you have a new kind of dynastic rule, the Pahlavis, and that happens in the 1920s. And then also the influence of communism and, you know, coming after the 1979 Russian Revolution also kind of influences a lot of the political ideology of Iran. And this is just, you know, a little bit more about that. I'll let you all kind of read through this on your own time. But I have included in this, and these are all hyperlinked as well, books that I think would be interesting if you're interested in reading more about this, especially the politics of gender and sexuality in, during the constitution, the Qajar and Constitutional Revolution. So these first two books, the Nejmabadi book, a really interesting book about the formation of gender and sexuality in Iran. And one thing I always like to say to people is that a lot of times we take for granted that the formation of gender and sexuality, as it looks like in our society, either in the United States or in Europe or in the global north in general, you know, we take for granted how that's developed or what that means. And all I want to say is that other places, including Iran, have forms of gender equality or forms of gender understandings of gender that don't map exactly onto what we envisage in the West. So it's not always fair to say we have better gender rights than other places when the development and practice of those kind of can look a little bit different. So it's not to say it's all relative. Obviously, there are some things, you know, that are different, but it is to say that those kind of books do give you a much better background on all of that. And I think they're interesting to consider. The other big epoch that I wanted to talk about, and I think is really important when engaging with issues of, you know, contemporary politics in the Middle East and especially U.S.-Iranian relations, is that Russia, Britain, and the U.S. have played an outsized role in controlling Iranian domestic policies, the economy, politics for a long time. And one of the biggest sort of inflection points of this kind of control of Russia and Britain, especially Russia, Britain and the United States, is what happened with one of the prime ministers of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, who is pictured here on the right hand side. So Mohammad Mossadegh was a sort of a what would you call it? Sort of a social democrat in his political outlook. Not quite a socialist, but kind of leaning that way a little bit. But his biggest, you know, maybe policy or what he wanted to implement was to take over the oil resources and put them and nationalize them, putting them back in the hands of the Iranians and Iranians benefiting economically from the oil resources. And his idea was to use the oil resources to develop the country, build roads, schools, you know, all the kind of things that, you know, people did during the industrial sort of period. He wanted, you know, Iran was going through that itself, but he wanted to use that revenue to do that. But of course, it's a kind of a long story, but a lot of the oil contracts that were given out under the Qajar period or under the first Shah Pahlavi really favored the West. They really made out like bandits in terms of the oil revenue and really sort of controlled everything to do with oil and revenues in the country. And so he wanted to take back that. He was, I think, one of the first leaders in the global South to make that move to try to nationalize Iran's oil resources. So not just for Iran was it important, but really, you know, if that was able to happen in that period of time, the world might look very, very different than it does now. But unfortunately, because he wanted to do that, he upset the powers that be at the time. And this is well documented, not something I'm just saying, but well documented. The British in particular and the Americans through MI6 and the CIA helped to overthrow Mossadegh in 1953, in August 1953, in a coup d'etat and reinstall the Shah as the leader, and immediately those oil contracts were again put into the hands of the British and the Americans. And it's just, you know, one thing to say that the oil company that was there was called the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, and that company still exists now, and it's called British Petroleum, or BP. And I personally avoided it at all costs, because I'm just like, think that that's terrible, and our country could have been very different had the Americans not done that. But it is a huge point, sticking point for a lot of Iranians, that they really feel that what happened with the, you know, after that with the Islamic Republic and all of that might have been averted had that not happened. So it's a really big thing in the Iranian mindset, for both leftists and right and conservatives. And this is, again, just some more books that I really recommend to people, mostly the ones on the right. The far right one talks all about the coup d'etat and the nationalism of Iranian oil. This is a great book and a really great historian. I definitely recommend it. And then these other three books don't just focus on Iran, but give a really good idea of kind of how, where oil dependency came from and how it became part of U.S. foreign policy. And so I really recommend these books, especially the one on the left, I think is really, really interesting. It mostly focuses on Saudi Arabia. So there you have the two big anchors in the Middle East, Iran and Saudi Arabia. But America's Kingdom is about the Aramco corporation in Saudi Arabia that still exists, and about how some of the racial politics in America at the time influenced the policies of Aramco in Saudi Arabia. So, for example, there was we're talking about 40s, 50s, Jim Crow era. A lot of the executives from the United States brought Jim Crow to Saudi Arabia in terms of how they set up the Aramco company. And so it's just a real interesting look at that. And anyway, you can have a look at that later. But the 1950s were a sort of revolutionary period. I mean, you did have the introduction of the Tudeh party in 1941, which Tudeh means the people or the masses party. So it was the main sort of communist socialist party in Iran. And communism and socialism were somewhat popular in Iran. I think that there's a way in which Iranian and to some other extent Islamic culture is very focused on hospitality and communalism. And so I think some of those principles then, you know, were familiar. And so here you have one of the greatest, sort of one of the most well-known writers of the period, who happened to be also a feminist and a socialist, Farrukh Farrakhzad. And she's really a pioneer, because she wrote about like her life and how some of these sort of oppressive ideologies, especially religious ideologies, you know, how she interacted with them or how she felt about them. So this, I love this particular poem. I'll just read the first lines. She says, God smiles on us, however many paths to the shore of his favor we haven't taken, because unlike the evil-doing, robe-wearing fanatics, we haven't drunk wine hidden from the eyes of God. And so women just didn't write about drinking. They didn't write about having sex. They didn't write about their feelings about the religious clerics. So she was really a pioneer in that sense. But the 1950s, there were a huge number of really interesting poets and writers, and she's one of my favorites. So if, you know, you look up that period, you could look her up. A lot of her poetry is translated into English. And then we hit the 1960s. So after the Qajars, after Mohammad Mossadegh, just before Mohammad Mossadegh, you have the first Shah. The first Shah is deposed, and his son becomes the next Shah, Reza Pahlavi. So the guy in this picture here, this guy and this guy, both of those are Reza Pahlavi, who is the Shah, or Shah means king or queen. So the monarchic ruler. And the Shahs are somewhat popular for some people in Iran because they introduced a lot of secularizing and policies in Iran and a lot of development of the country in what they called the White Revolution of 1963. So I have that there. So in 1963, beginning of the White Revolution, women are granted suffrage as well. So women have the right to vote starting in 1963. And it's a real interesting time period on a lot of levels, because there still exists a sort of, and that's why I put there at the top, 1962, Jalal Ali Ahmed's Occidentosis. So there's leftist Iranians who are secular, but still critical of the West. Again, this is like 10 years after Mohammad Mossadegh, but still kind of interested in reforming Iran. And so one of the people that kind of writes about criticizing the West, but not from necessarily from a completely Islamic perspective, is this Jalal Ali Ahmed. And that book in particular had a lot of influence on Iranian society left and right, but also on some of the eventual Islamic clerics of Iran who used that. And then another figure, Ali Shariati, who was kind of the main intellectual architect of the Islamic Revolution, the 1979 revolution. And he was a Marxist, which might sound funny. And he kind of wrote a lot of books that kind of mixed communism and Shia Islam, what he used to call red and black Shiaism. So he considered the tradition of Shia Islam from the Safavid period. I'm sorry, I know I'm going into some details. Safavid, so the main kind of main Islam as quietist, not very politically savvy, not, you know, getting involved in politics. And he sort of revisioned it to be much more focused on maybe helping the poor. I think maybe a good analogy would be, what do you call that in Latin America? The liberation theology. It's kind of a liberation theology, that same kind of thing in Catholicism, same kind of ideas, but brought that into Islam. It looks a little different, but that's what he did. And an interesting story about that is that, so he wrote a book on red and black Shiaism, and he was a contemporary of a lot of these French other intellectuals like Camus and Jean-Paul Sartre. And there's interesting and Frantz Fanon. And there's really interesting exchanges you can find between Frantz Fanon and Ali Shariati, or Ali Shariati and Jean-Paul Sartre. And there's one letter between Jean-Paul Sartre and Ali Shariati where Jean-Paul Sartre is telling Ali Shariati that if he mixes religion with Marxism, it's going to go bad, basically, that it'll be taken over by right-wing religious fanatics and it won't look like, you know, what he envisages it to look like. But he's like, no, you know, I believe in our people, they'll be able to do it. But unfortunately, that is what happened. But Ali Shariati, people always think that the architect was Khomeini, but really it was Ali Shariati, the intellectual architect of the idea of an Islamic Republic, but coming more from the Marxist tradition. And he was also very, and I'm sorry, okay, I see the time. He was also very, I think this quote is very interesting. I maybe won't go into all of it, but I think it's just important to mention that that there's kind of a difference between modernity and civilization, right? And I think there's like this idea that the most modern societies are in the global north or Europe, and you know, so he was really criticizing that. He's saying, you know, is modernity a form of civilization? Does that make you more civilized, or does modernity look different in different places in different countries? And I love this quote, and I'll let you read that on your own time, but Ali Shariati, one of my favorites. So Ali Shariati did influence, you know, thinking and writing in the 60s, was killed in 1977 in the UK under suspicious circumstances. They think probably It was the Shah's Savak, the secret police. And maybe interestingly for some of you, the Savak, the secret police of Iran, was originally set up with help by the Israeli government, of course. And the Savak was used by the Shah, Reza Pahlavi, to really oppress any kind of resistance to his reign, especially left-wing people, imprisoned, tortured them. And also the Shah was hated because he was an autocrat, and a lot of the policies, the sort of quote-unquote modernizing policies that he implemented, really only benefited a small amount of elites at the top. And that's why I kind of hate when people show these pictures of like 1970s Iran versus like chador wearing, you know, women after that, because a lot of those policies weren't beneficial to the masses of people. They were beneficial to just a few, and women weren't wearing miniskirts all over Iran. They were with some like coming from more secular backgrounds or from more city urban backgrounds or more economically elite backgrounds might have worn that stuff, but a lot of the masses did not. Anyway, the Shah was very unpopular for his selling off Iranian resources to the West and these autocratic policies. And there was a lot of organizing between the left and the right, and overthrown in 1979. I think everybody knows about this, so I'm not going to go into it, but these are some just some pictures of that time. And there's a lot of artwork from that time that people can have a look at. I won't go into too much of the ideology of the Islamic Revolution, but like I said before, Ali Shariati sort of came up with it, but it was really Ayatollah Khomeini who was the main driver of the adoption of this idea of Islamic Republic. And I won't go into too much of that. If somebody has questions, I can talk about that. But obviously in 1979, lots of different groups, including women, communists, but also just peasant classes, all different kinds of people organized together to overthrow the Shah. And there was a lot of different discussions on what would come in its stead. But unfortunately, the sort of more hardline Islamic elements were able to take over the revolution and declared a Jumhuriya Islami or an Islamic Republic, where Ayatollah Khomeini was the sort of main leader, dictator of the country. And then underneath him was a guardian council made up of all male Islamic clerics who oversee every part of the government until this day. Now, Khomeini died not too long, you know, I think in 1989. And he was replaced by another leader called Khamenei. So people sometimes get those confused. So the first one was Khomeini and the second one was Khamenei. And I think people do know some of this. Right after the revolution in 79, there was the Iran-Iraq war and also the storming of the U.S. embassy and things like that. I won't go into that because I know that's kind of common knowledge. We know, again, another thing that I should just mention, why Iranians are sort of upset is also about the U.S. interference after Mossadegh. The United States got involved in the Iran-Iraq war, sold weapons to both sides during the war, opposed a ceasefire in the U.N., just like they're doing now. And the war went on for, I think, 8 or 9 years. Nearly a million people died before they accepted a ceasefire. And then in the 1990s, there was a brief moment where a more reformist, more social democrat leader got elected, Khatami. And there was some movement towards creating more freedoms for Iranians in that time, especially a student movement. But that was heavily put down by the secret police in particular, but also by the military. And then since the That was 1999 in the early 2000s. And since probably, I think, about 2008 or 9, the trajectory of politics, like after Khatami, after that left-wing person, a number of the new presidents, Ahmadinejad, Rouhani, Raisi, are all very kind of right-wing people. And just with the last, I'm going to just take 2 more minutes and then I'll go to questions. But during the early 2000s, one of the most significant kind of women's rights organizations and movements happened called the 1 Million Signatures Campaign. That campaign was there to advocate for equality in the law. So after 1979, not only did women have to, did they implement compulsory hijab, but they also implemented a number of interpretations of Islamic law that made women really second-class citizens. And by that, I mean things like women were not allowed to inherit the same as a man. Women did not have the same rights to divorce as a man. They didn't have the same rights to child custody. Women were not allowed to dance or sing in public. Women were not allowed to hold roles that they had under the Shah's time. So, for example, this woman right here is called Shireen Ebadi. She won the Nobel Peace Prize as well. She was a judge until she was removed from her place after the 79 revolution. And all of these women were involved in the 1 million signatures campaign. This is Nasreen Sudaté. She's one of the most famous human rights lawyers, in prison many, many times. This is Parveen Ardalan. She is really the architect of the 1 million signatures campaign and one of the foremost women's rights activists in Iran. And this is, people might know, this is Narges Mohammadi. She wrote a book, and she was just last year, given the Nobel Peace Prize for her work for gender equality, but also she was also asking for abolition of the death penalty in Iran, and that is why she is currently in jail. And then this last kind of couple years have been big years in terms of protest after protest. So 2009, just before the Arab Spring, there was a big protest in Iran called the Green Movement that was really focused on parliamentary reforms. But the killing of a woman called Neda Sultan was the impetus for that kind of starting of that Green Movement. So Neda is there. She was killed sort of randomly when she attended a protest. And the slogan of that protest was, "Where is my vote?" Nothing necessarily came out of that protest. But in the years since 2017, 2018, kind of the spirit of those protests continue. There's a lot of unhappiness around corruption and subsidies of the Iranian state. And there continues to be sort of economically organized protests. Until this last period in 2022, 16th of September 2022, Jinha Mahsa Amini, a young Kurdish woman, she's 22 years old, coming from one of the provinces in Iran, one of the Kurdish provinces, went to Tehran. She wasn't, according to the state, wasn't wearing her hijab the correct way. And what happens is that the morality police pick you up if they think you're not wearing the correct, you know, outfit, hijab or manto, a covering, and they bring you to a re-education center. And a lot of the times in these centers, people are humiliated, brutalized, raped, etc. It's a very common experience for women in Iran. And in her case, she was beaten to death. And killed, and this started a big uprising against the government, and it's really kind of huge for us, because if you see here on the left, I don't know if you guys will be able to read this, but it's these young school-aged girls, so they're in primary school or in high school age, is what I'm talking about. They have taken off their hijabs, which is mandatory, you know, to wear to school. And they're giving the finger, as you can see, to the words Jumhuriya Islami. So they're expressing distaste for the idea of an Islamic Republic. And this is like a huge, they're really like, it's a huge red line in Iran. Like, this has never happened. Usually you could get, you could be killed for this. And a lot of young people have, very unfortunately, hundreds of young people, and I'm talking about under 18, 16, 17 year olds, have been imprisoned or killed for uprising against the government. And then on the right hand side, and I know I have to finish, I'm so sorry, is a very famous singer in Iran who wrote a song called Baroya, Because Of, and he took the tweets of a lot of people after Mahsa Amini died, who expressed dissatisfaction with the government for a lot of different reasons. He took all of those tweets and created a beautiful song. These are the words of the song. And unfortunately, because he wrote that song, he is been sentenced to 3 years in prison just for that song and many, many others. And the Iranian government has used this period of time to continue their horrible policy of executions of political prisoners. That, I mean, this time during this genocide in Gaza, they have taken that as an opportunity to just continue to execute people at levels that we haven't seen previous. But people continue to resist, and they resist under the slogan Zan Zandegi Azadi, or Jin Jiyan Azadi, women, life, freedom. The first is Persian, the second is Kurdish, Kurmanji. And that's where that slogan comes from. It actually comes from kind of a militant feminist a group in mostly in Turkey called Congress of Star. Kurds who followed the PKK, the Kurdish Workers' Party, have long been feminists. Their leader, Abdullah Öcalan, is also a feminist. And that slogan actually comes from the Kurdish women's movement. And that's been there for decades, actually, years and years. And then recently, the Iranian women's movement adopted that and the principles of that, and have been working to overthrow the government, but mostly, you know, besides for that, in the medium or short term, to try to demand equality in the law for women and minorities in Iran, which is a continuing struggle. So I'll stop there. Sorry it's so long, but I'll take questions. Thank you.
We can continue if anybody else has any more questions. Well, in closing this program, I want to remind everybody that Farah's father, who is living in, is a Louisvillian, has a lot of family in Iran. He has siblings and nieces and nephews and so forth there. So Farah is personally connected with Iran in very distinct ways. Farah, thank you so very much for this program. You know, I was a history major in college, so as your slides were coming across, my heart was thumping with my interest in history. But anyway, this is our last program of the season. We don't meet May through August, but we'll be back on September the 19th, and I hope you all will mark your calendars. As I say goodbye, I want to recognize the team for these Third Thursday lunches. You can see some of our faces on the screen. It is a team effort, and it's a creative effort. Unlike some other committees I've been on, everybody makes a contribution in terms of discussing the programs and preparing the invitations and sending them out and all that sort of thing. So here we go. I'm the chair. And our members of the formal committee are Kathy Ford. Here's Kathy. Jim Johnson, Barbara Boyd, a former member of the committee who's moved up to New York State, is Rhody Streeter over there. Our technical team is David Horvath and Mark Mead. Mark, there you go. And Jim Johnson, with his radio programs and that sort of thing, is a member of the team. Informally, the steering committee of the FOR is so active here. You see Cindy Sheldor's picture here and Carolyn Brooks over there. They staff the tables when we're at Hotel Louisville, and other members of the steering committee. And so across the summer, we'll be working hard on what our programs will be in the fall. The Fellowship of Reconciliation is very much a part of what's going on in the world. And we were founded in 1915 in the opening years of the First World War. And we're an international organization. So we're involved in international issues as well as local issues of importance. And our programs next fall and spring will cover issues like that. It is a coincidence, although we had invited Farah several months ago to speak, we were very much aware, of course, that Iran was hovering on the edges of the situation in Gaza, but we did not know that coincidence would bring us to this unfortunate point today where Iran, United States, Israel are involved in war and possible war. But in any case, we're peacemakers, and we need to remember that. And our speaker today is a peacemaker par excellence across all her adult lives. And so we're so delighted that she came to us today. So thanks again for being our loyal audience, and we'll see you again in September. Bye-bye for now.
Folks, we're out of time. We want to thank the Louisville Fellowship of Reconciliation and Swords of Justice for producing the Third Thursday Lunch event. We also want to thank our guest today, Farah Mosherar Sharveh. The X is our program that features Farah Mosherar Sharveh will air again April 25th at 11 a.m. and April 26th at 1 p.m. You can listen live stream if you visit us at forwardradio.org and click on Listen Live Now. You can also listen via our archives if you visit our website. Scroll down to Program Archives and then scroll down to the Access Hour program that features Farah Mosherar Sharveh. If you would like to comment on today's program, visit us at solutionsofviolence18@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Our editor is Carolyn Brooks Johnson for Solutions of Violence and the Access Hour and WFMP 106.5 FM Radio. I'm Jim Johnson.